Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
This is Richard Martin again. This is Richard Martin's wake-up call, and I am here to tell you that we still have no call-in line. I have put a call through to the head of the Progressive Radio Network to find out where we stand with this, and I haven't heard from him, so I don't have any news for you, but in the meantime, as always, please feel free to submit your questions through the email to me at the following address, and all lowercase, please, rmartin@gscorporation.com. I will repeat that if you are still frantically scrambling for a pencil and a piece of paper. It is, again, I will repeat it, the G, by the way, the G and the S stand for Global Strategic, and please be sure to write the word corporation out in full, and once again, it's all lowercase, and the address is rmartin@gscorporation.com. Please feel free to write in at any time during this coming hour, and I will get your email immediately. It arrives, and then I will read it out at an opportune moment and discuss it. All right. I had mentioned last time, or the time before, the scandal of the jobs figures that came out at the beginning of this month pertaining to the month of April, and how they were so heavily skewed by the birth-death phenomenon. I'm not going to go into details again on that score because many of you will have listened to my talk on that account. But I thought it would be interesting to flesh out in a little bit more detail why it is that the government feels it's so necessary to lie to people in the way they do. In particular, the jobs report was immensely celebrated because it fits so perfectly with what most of Wall Street desperately wants to believe. You know, if you talk to people, investors, investment managers, anybody in the business, they are very anxious to believe this second half rebound story. It always comes up. Any year where the market has done badly in the first half of the year, automatically you are told that the second half rebound is just around the corner. And when the second half goes badly, you're going to be told about the end of year rally and the bright prospects of the following year. And this year is no exception. People seem to sort of accept as true the notion that the global economy will not be affected by financial turmoil centered in the United States. They have absolute faith in the power of the Fed, even though the Fed has manifestly failed them over the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years. You know, though the financial system was on the edge of Armageddon in mid-March before the bailout of Bear Stearns counterparties, some additional rate cuts from the Fed and implicit Fed guarantees of bad debt supposedly will make it all better. They want to believe that the Fed put will forever shield them from their reckless speculative actions, including monstrous leverage much of which still hangs over the market today. They hope that the temporary rebate check stimulus will be enough to restart the consumer spending orgy that had been raging in this country nonstop for nearly 15 years. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure it's become clear to you right now what my attitude to all this is, namely, it's all a grand illusion. The wrongful path of financial irresponsibility that this country and many other mature Western nations, by the way, as well, has taken cannot continue. It has to end. Even the French are beginning to understand this. The comments by the French Prime Minister, François Fillon, are notable from last month as he justified the planned implementation of social spending cutbacks, and I quote, "A country that spends more than it earns, that lives artificially beyond its means, is a country that is morally weak, economically vulnerable, and socially suicidal," end of quote. Well, wouldn't it be nice if we could get truth-speaking government leaders like that into this country? But what do they do instead? Hand out checks, euphemistically called tax rebates, using borrowed money as the national debt spirals ever higher, $9.35 trillion and counting, in order to spur one last binge of consumption. Slash interest rates and print money at double-digit rates of growth. Offer unprecedented government guarantees to speculating financial entities that were enormously leveraged and had reaped the profits from that leverage in recent years. Issue low-balled inflation reports and overstated employment and GDP results. American leaders do whatever it takes to keep the financial house of cards upright for just that little bit longer. Well, economists who follow the Austrian school of economic theory know that in the long run, delaying the inevitable this way only makes things worse. The famed economist Ludwig von Mises wrote, and I quote, "Expansion of credit does lead to a boom at first, it is true, but sooner or later, this boom is bound to crash and bring about a new depression. Only apparent and temporary relief can be won by tricks of banking and currency. In the long run, they must land the nation in profounder catastrophe. For all the damage such methods inflict on national well-being is all the heavier, the longer people have managed to deceive themselves with the illusion of prosperity, which the continuous creation of credit has conjured up." Another Austrian school economist, the US-based Murray Rothbard, also notes that it takes, quote, "ever larger doses of credit expansion to keep the artificial booms going, and that the end result ensures that the downturn inevitably will be longer and more grueling," end of quote. After the credit-induced tech bubble burst earlier this decade, the U.S. government was successful in limiting the damage to just the manufacturing sector, thereby lengthening the exceedingly long-running period without a consumer spending downturn. Doing so took a massive credit expansion, heavy fiscal spending, tax rebate checks, and the largest semi-permanent tax rate cuts on record. Even with all these stimulative approaches, the economic recovery was lackluster. Today, after the credit-induced housing bubble has burst, inflicting more widespread damage to the broader economy than the tech bubble collapse, there's a huge budget deficit, limiting fiscal spending options. Rates have been cut to 2%, but the dollar has plunged and commodity prices have soared. This week, the Republican leadership in Congress issued a letter to the Democratic leadership calling for hearings on the dollar's decline, including the impact of the Fed's rate-cutting campaign on the falling dollar and on the rapidly rising prices of food and energy. "We cannot stand idly by while the dollar's value continues to plummet, pushing up food and energy prices and lowering the American people's standard of living. Mr. Market may be putting restraints on the Fed through the dollar and commodity market gyrations." This week, the Fed hinted that it might be done cutting rates at 2%. The ever larger doses of credit expansion to keep artificial booms such as this one going may not be as forthcoming this time around. Tax rebate monies are being issued currently, but the impact will only last for a few months, There are no significant tax rate cuts planned. In fact, the tax rate cuts from earlier this decade will likely be reversed if either of the Democratic candidates wins this fall's presidential election. The Fed's rate cuts to 2% have not had much of an effect on long-term mortgage rate. Jumbo mortgage rates are nearly as expensive as they were a year ago. There will be no housing boom to lift the economy this time. In fact, the housing depression continues to worsen as double-digit declines in home prices nationwide are steepening, burdened by the enormous glut of unsold homes and the worsening foreclosure crisis. In short, it doesn't look like there's enough juice to keep this expansion going. It takes time for downturns to develop into their full nastiness, and this one is no exception. Historically, severe recessions, depressions, are always punctuated by brief periods of euphoria, one of which we are in now. The stock market's progression at the onset of the worst depression in this country's history parallels very much what we are seeing today. And that was in 1929, or actually 1930, after the crash in 29. At every market rallying point, investors believed then that the worst was behind them. Well, they were wrong. And they were very wrong. The turmoil is not limited, by the way, to the U.S. There's a reason why the U.S. Federal Reserve decided on Friday to nearly double its offers of loans to the European and Swiss central banks. And it's not because the Fed is flush with cash. The money is expected to be relent from the central banks to struggling European banks. The Fed is doing this because the credit crunch is currently hitting European banks hard. This is a worldwide credit crunch, though the troubles are concentrated in the areas where housing bubbles are bursting. The US, the UK, and much of continental Europe, excluding Germany. Recent headlines from around the world are not encouraging. Last week, the Bank of Japan sharply reduced its growth forecast for 2008 in its semi-annual outlook to just 1.5% from its previous forecast of 2.1%. The bank also eliminated its bias towards raising rates for the first time in 2 years. The Bank of Japan said that in the first half of fiscal 2008, and I quote, deceleration in the economy seems likely to continue due mainly to the slowdown in overseas economies, especially in the U.S., and the effects of high energy and materials prices, end of quote. Japan's economy is the second largest in the world next to the U.S. Germany's IFO Institute reported last week that business sentiment fell hard in March, to the lowest level in over 2 years. On Friday, the German Federal Statistics Office reported that March retail sales unexpectedly fell for the second month in a row. The German economy is the third largest in the world. In China, the fourth largest in the world, economic growth has begun to fall slightly from high levels, but the stock market has plunged since the October peak, wiping out nearly 50% of its value, before a recent rebound inspired by government actions to prop the market up. The fifth largest economy, the UK, has begun to keel over due to a housing crisis that might turn out to be more severe than that of the US. The first quarter economic growth in the UK fell to the lowest level in 3 years. The financial services sector is reeling from the global credit crunch year after year, year over year. Sorry, housing starts dropped by almost a third in March. Mortgage approvals fell by almost 50% to their lowest level on record, and house prices in April posted their first drop in 12 years. London's Longview Economics is forecasting eventual home price declines of 20 to 30%. Just like in the U.S., home equity withdrawals are dropping fast. Last month, UK mortgage lenders stopped offering no-money-down mortgages to first-time home buyers. Now they have to put up a minimum of 10%. Not surprisingly, retail sales in April fell to their lowest level since November 2005. In France, the sixth largest economy in the world, house price inflation peaked 3 years ago at 16% and is now close to turning negative. The French statistical agency, ANSSE, reported last week that consumer confidence hit a 21-year low in April. And they also reported a sharp fall-off in business sentiment. Retail sales in Italy, the seventh in the world economy, fell at their fastest pace in 4 years in March. Business confidence declined to the lowest level in 2.5 years. Last month, the International Monetary Fund cut its GDP growth forecast for Italy to just over 0.3% for all of 2008. At number 8, Spain's new government is planning a US-style fiscal stimulus package to prop up the badly sagging economy. Spain's housing bubble, the worst in the world, has burst, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later on. Home sales transactions are falling at double-digit rates year over year. Unemployment in the first quarter rose at the fastest pace in 15 years and is now nearing 10%. In Canada, the world's ninth largest economy, the Bank of Canada 2 weeks ago slashed interest rates by 0.5 percentage point for the second time in 2 months and also reduced its outlook for economic growth to just 1.4%, down from 1.8%. And I quote, "The bank is now projecting a deeper and more protracted slowdown in the U.S. economy," end of quote. That comes from the Bank of Canada itself. Continuing, "This has direct consequences for the Canadian economic outlook, with declining exports projected to exert a significant drag on growth in 2008. In addition, tightening credit conditions and softening sentiment are expected to moderate business investment and consumer spending." Well, ladies and gentlemen, I could go on. Brazil, Russia, India, I mean, everybody is hurting today. So anybody who tells you that it's just the United States is suffering from a severe bout of ignorance. And if I've taken the trouble to mention all this information to you about the rest of the world, believe me, there is a reason, and that reason has to do with a concerted downturn that we are about to see worldwide, and no economy will escape or be spared. Okay, let me just give you my information. Richard Martin is the name, and Richard Martin's Wake Up Call is the program. We come to you from the Progressive Radio Network in New York, and I am talking to you from Miami, Florida. And I will give you my email address once again. For those of you who have just come online and were not available at the beginning of the program, there is no call-in line today. Anybody who wishes to ask a question for the next 40 minutes, feel free, please, to do so by writing to me by email at the following address. All lowercase, please. rmartin@gscorporation.com. All right, I will repeat that. The GS stands for Global Strategic, company where I work, Global Strategic Investments, and the word corporation should be written out, please, in full. Once again, all lowercase, the address is rmartin@gscorporation.com. So write away your question, and when it comes up, I will see it, and I will refer to it as soon as I have an appropriate break in the proceedings. Now, if you'd like to call me direct, as several people are doing these days, you may do so. And my direct line, my number is 305-357-5575. Please feel free to do so anytime. I will look forward to hearing from you. Once again, the number is 305-357-5575. Okay. And I will not give you the call-in number today. No call-ins. As I said, when I have had a chance to talk to the manager of the station, I will hopefully have more information from you. And, of course, we're all hoping that we will be back on Thursday with the call-in line. Okay, I thought I would just talk to you a little bit more about how it is that people are so very wrong about the prognostications that they make. And this is not necessarily to do with casting an aspersion on their intelligence or their powers of analysis. It's really the difference, I think, between a business owner who has the vision to see what the future will offer him in terms of the kind of business that he wishes to set up. And the kind of business owner who simply makes mistakes in setting up businesses which are destined to fail. That's the way I really look at this. There is some luck involved, yes, but I think one of the things I come down on so heavily is the kind of nonsensical viewpoints that people seem to hold that really make no sense. And I wish it were not the case, but unfortunately, when you have people like David Luray, who write books saying, you know, that the housing boom will go on forever, or whatever his book was called, when he came out with it in 2006, and of course the market then promptly turned around and went the other way. Anybody who is bullish on the housing market can take some kind of encouragement from the fact that this moron is now saying it's going to get worse. There was an interview in Newsweek with the ex-National Association of Realtors economist, David Luray, where he said, and I quote, "I just didn't realize the scope, the extent, the magnitude of the loose underwriting, not looking at income and wages, just providing so many mortgage loans based on expected future price appreciation rather than the creditworthiness of the borrower. That got so out of hand, and none of us realized the magnitude of it until it was too late." End of quote. Well, none of us does not include any listener to the Richard Martin wake-up call. So if anybody knows of David Luray, they might like to get in touch with him and suggest that he, you know, turn his computer on twice a week and hear it from us here, because we knew what was going to happen and we were making fun of David Luray as he was coming out with his ludicrous pronouncements. But now that he's bearish and he has capitulated, you know, the normal rule of thumb is that when the worst offender turns, that's the time for you to turn. But I'm still not going to tell you to buy houses, ladies and gentlemen. We've got at least 3 or 4 years to go, so hold your horses on that one. Another one, John Lansner, the Orange County Register, he was mentioned, this expert, so-called, was mentioned on the front page of the Orange County Register in 2005. He of course, was talking up the market, and when he was asked, "Where did you go wrong?" His answer, you know, was, along with almost everyone else, "I didn't recognize that the 2003 through 2006 housing market boom was caused almost exclusively by the introduction and pushing of low teaser rate loans." So the question then was, well, what was it you didn't foresee? Where did the demand go? And he says, "Shame on me. After 40 years of analyzing my way through 4 economic and housing market booms and busts, I knew that the fuel for every boom also eventually burns it up and causes it to go bust. I had my head in the sand and wasn't paying attention. If I had been paying attention, I would have known that a high percentage of those low teaser rate loans would go into foreclosure and bring the whole house of greed tumbling down. But I wasn't paying attention." Well, it's nice of him to admit it, but the problem is that we all need to pay attention, and we need to concentrate and not take our eye off the ball. And this is just as true of markets which turn back up again after they go down as those which turn down after they've been up, you know, for a long period of time. You know, the system is broken. Every action by the Fed says so. Those that anticipate a shallow recession still do not understand this. The credit crunch has barely begun affecting the real economy. We're in the very early stages of this process, and the government wants to boil the proverbial toad, in other words, the middle class, as slowly as possible. Risk is very high. You know, the private market, with the encouragement of the Federal Reserve, has manufactured vast debt that can never be repaid. Banks used up their capital long ago. So the Fed has to take those bad loans away from them and give them capital back. Stabilization is not a working banking system. When you hear all the CEOs of Wall Street say the crisis is nearing an end, it has no implication for a working banking system that will create more credit. The Fed adds a new twist every day. Now it's going to pay interest on reserves bank must keep at the Fed. This has never been done before. The banks have to keep their reserves free of interest at the Fed. That's part of what fractional reserve banking is all about. But this will now allow the Fed to expand its balance sheet even more and buy even more bad loans from banks. This is not a positive, ladies and gentlemen. It illustrates just how bad things are. By the way, of course, needless to say, it's the U.S. taxpayer that will be picking up a good portion of this interest that they will now pay to the banks. All right, some mail has come in. I got quite a long email here from Hugh Thomas, so I will read it to you, and I have not read it, so I have no idea what we're in for. You and I, ladies and gentlemen, are going to be discovering this email for the first time together. Dear Mr. Martin, firstly, let me thank you for your informative and disturbing response to my email of 2 weeks ago regarding the possibility of emergency government appropriation of private bank balances for national fiscal management purposes with a cautionary account of recent Argentinian history. I didn't rush to close out my accounts, but did realize that yours and others' reports of private sector deception and fraud increased government permission thereof, as well as the dilution of our currency to go some distance before out-and-out bank robbery. I was struck by a remark you made regarding a possible positive fallout from the massive correction looming on the horizon, in that this U.S. population might divest itself of delusions of endless horizons of consumption and privilege vis-a-vis the rest of the world. This reminded me of a lengthy article that appeared in Counterpunch, an alternative online political economic news and commentary source, about a year ago by, I think, Craig Roberts, if I have the name right, in which it was revealed that the pipelines within our own industrial base of theoretical, creative, and technical expertise, normally maintained as an ongoing internal investment of an industry, has been to a large part destroyed, and that the belief that all we need to do to get back our industrial base is to build a plant and set up an employment office is something of a delusion. William Manchester, in his history of the Krupp Arms and Machinery Company of Germany, described how it maintained its engineering, metallurgical, and machine-operating human capital through the worst of the 1920s to reemerge with devastating effects in World War II. Short of authoritarian paternalism, is there a lesson here? Some thoughts for your possible comment. Thank you again, Hugh Thomas. That's a good one, Hugh. I definitely believe that we are seeing the gradual takeover of the what is left of our industrial base by government-sponsored organizations, and by which I do mean, companies that provide the armaments for the huge military machine that is currently holding sway over the economies of the world. And it's very clear that if the manufacturing in this country has dwindled to practically zero, and most of what's left is in fact involved with government-sponsored manufacture of armaments, the government is, whether by design or default, simply increasing its hold over the population, because despite what anybody says, the important aspects of any economy are the ones involved in manufacturing and wealth creation, as opposed to the service industries. So in exactly the same way as it is true that the armaments industry created the power machine for the Third Reich in Germany in the 1930s, there is no question that the government has greater control over the productive means of wealth creation today, and it doesn't bode well for the future. I have no idea where this is going to lead. I'm not going to pretend that I'm a conspiracy theorist, and again, I don't like to wade into politics, so I'm not going to go there either. But it is very clear that the government is inexorably gaining a stranglehold over what is left of the manufacturing base. And there is a lesson there, but the problem, Hugh, is that lesson will not be learned, and I don't mean by the government, but by the people. In other words, the people will never come to understand what is going on and therefore, unfortunately, they will have to suffer whatever consequences then, you know, come down for us all. Thank you very much for your informative and interesting email. Marguerite King has sent me an email where she says, my grandparents lost $50,000 in the crash of 1929. If another depression happens and banks closes in the case of my grandparents, will the FDIC insurance pay depositors like myself for the loss of my life savings? I am disabled and cannot work to assure my survival. Marguerite, I know you're not a new person on this show, so I am aware that the chances are very high that you have heard me say several times, if your deposits amount to $100,000 or less, the FDIC will reimburse you for any bank failures. Be careful, though, to ensure that whatever investments you choose to make at the bank are themselves subject to that FDIC proviso. And only by checking with the bank can you double-check that. If you have an interest-bearing account, a simple interest account at the bank, that will be covered. If you buy a money market fund, that probably won't, because that's not an investment of the bank. That's a separate investment that the bank may have bought for you. So be very careful to ensure that whatever money you have at the bank stays as money, albeit in savings accounts, and that it remains under $100,000 per depositor and with the wrinkles that I have mentioned before, but you should be fine. There was no insurance, you see, in 1929. So that if you had money in the bank, you stood to lose everything, and many, many people did. Okay, now we have an email from John entitled Shorting the Markets. And his question is, from a financial survival point of view, can one safely short the markets as they inevitably collapse? Thanks, John in New York. Well, safety is relative, isn't it, John? Is it safe to walk across the road? Is it safe to take a plane from New York to California? Is it safe to go skydiving? I mean, there are different definitions of safety. My definition of shorting markets in an overvalued market at the beginning of a depression is very high. In other words, the safety is, I think, an extremely high value in that kind of an operation. So at this point in time, I would say your risk is very, very minimal, but you do have to know what you're doing. Shorting the markets is actually more profitable in many respects than buying the markets long at the market bottoms. But there are things you need to know, not quite as simple as buying stocks. Shorting, for those of you who don't know, means selling something before you own it, and then as it loses value, buying it back for less than you sold it for, and thereby reaping the profit between the price you sold it originally and then the price you bought it back. Frivolously, I usually compare it to going into a restaurant and starting with the dessert, having the main course, and ending up with the starter, and basically you eat the same food, you pay the same check, you have exactly the same amount of calories, and you are exactly as unhungry as you were at the beginning, but you just did things the other way around. You just basically started at the end and finished at the beginning. That's basically what shorting is all about. And it is very lucrative, and I believe that it is appropriate, very appropriate, actually, at a time like this. So the answer is the safety is much higher at this point than it would be at other points of the cycle when the market is much, much lower. I have an email here from somebody called E41, who says, since 1992, 22 hospitals have closed in Jersey, including 6 in the last 18 months. Of the 76 remaining hospitals, half reported losing money. welcome to the land of private medicine. I don't know what else to say. Excellent piece of information there. Nice factoid for us all. Thank you, E41. I appreciate that. I have two emails, actually, from Steve Kruger, who can always be relied upon to entertain us with his erudition. And I will read you the first of the two emails. Richard, we have three political bandits fighting for the nation's top elected post. In view of the financial soup we are sinking in, I have to ask myself, why would anyone knock themselves out fighting to be the cap of the Titanic when we are 6 inches away from the iceberg? It all seems like a grab for power at any price. Or they have simply no clue as to the forthcoming events. Steve Kruger. Now, Steve, for somebody of your intelligence, it is very disappointing to think that you are not aware that these people are totally ignorant. I mean, you did say they simply have no clue. That's an understatement. McCain himself is almost proud to admit, and has done so on several occasions, that he isn't very strong in the economy. He doesn't know much about it, and he needs to educate himself. This is a man who is about to take over the most parlous, dangerous economic cycle ever in the history of this country as president, if he so becomes. And he claims he doesn't understand the economy. And this is like a pilot getting on a plane and saying, just before you take off, ladies and gentlemen, I'm the pilot. Well, I'm actually not the pilot, really. I'm the pilot's cousin, but the pilot's fallen asleep, and so I'm going to fly the plane. He mentioned a couple of things about this button over here and a little lever over here. So we're going to have a go. We're going to see how it works. I really should have learned about flying a bit before this happened, but too late, really. I can't help it. So let's go. Off we go. Tighten your seatbelts and sit back and relax and let's see what happens. I mean, you know, it really is pretty much the same thing. And you can see how Bush, MBA though he claims to be, has absolutely no idea what's going on. His proclamations are the words out of Henry Paulson. And actually, if you've watched him, if you've ever watched him, if you watched the president standing beside Paulson at the time when he's supposed to say something, the anguished glances that Paulson gives him belie the whole story. In other words, is this loose cannon going to say something totally out of line, or are we going to get out of this alive? Unfortunately, Steve, these people have no idea what's going on. 6 inches away from the iceberg is a very good analogy. We'll all go down, and Americans will be none the wiser at the end of it all. There is simply no sense of maturity about this problem. No sense that anybody really understands what's happening. And that's, I guess, why I have to be here filling in, you know, the gaps on Richard Martin's wake-up call. Steve, your other email is as follows, and it is it's a little rant, so I think we're going to listen to it, and here goes. It's entitled The Fed and Tax. Richard, to me it seems like we've been on a course for financial destruction since 1913. Over the years, we had two declared wars that were paid for with cash and war bonds and with strict controls on spending. We also had many undeclared wars that were paid for with unbacked paper money with zero control on how the money is spent. In fact, Vietnam was why we got off the gold standard, as many of our creditors asked to be paid in gold. Nixon would have none of that. Since 1971, our dollar started its massive downward slide that continues till today. To me, our financial path since 1913 seems to be planned and not an accident by any means. We say the Fed chairmen have acted like fools, but we assume they have the nation's best interests at heart, which they do not. To me, it feels like they want to return to the 17th century Europe, where all the money was held by about 15% of the people and no middle class at all. Richard, could you discuss the creation of the Fed and our income tax system arriving in the same year and the apparent need for both to get us to where we are today? Thank you, Steve Kruger. Steve, I would. I have no problem with discussing the creation of the Fed. I have done that, though. I spent a lot of time talking about the Fed in the earlier talks that I gave when I started Richard Martin's wake-up call on PRN. You may have heard some of them. I went through the creation of the Fed, you know, several times and the concept of money. In fact, my very first wake-up call talk was entitled "What is Money?" And I discussed the actual definition of money in some detail, and then included in it, of course, was a discussion of the Federal Reserve. The important thing you need to know, the Federal Reserve is a bit like the appendix. It really has no use. It doesn't have any need to be. Not only does it not have a need to be, but as most of you have been told ad infinitum by myself, it is an illegal operation. The Constitution requires that money and the issuance of money be controlled by the Treasury Department of the government, not by a private corporation. I don't really get it, why people seem to think that it was basically something which followed naturally from an economy which required some hidden body to talk about things which were duplicated in other areas of the economy. So you have to ask yourself why the Federal Reserve was created. And it was quite clearly created, especially after the banking crisis of 1907, to protect the interests of the banks, to make sure that the banks were run by an organization friendly towards the interests and the needs of the banks and the financial services, as opposed to being a representative of the people, such as was intended by the founders of the country. And you see that most eloquently with the bailout of Bear Stearns. Bear Stearns was simply a private corporation, as private as any other corporation doing any other kind of business. It happened to be financial. They could have been producing lawnmowers, you know, or caskets, or travel tours to Indonesia. It happened to be involved in people's investments. And so, because of that, the Federal Reserve bailed them out because they were in the same boat and they were all in the money business. Do you see the Federal Reserve bailing out a lawnmower company that happens to be in difficulty? Or Linens and Things when it went bankrupt a few weeks ago? I didn't see the Federal Reserve coming around with a bunch of money or using a bigger company and giving it money to bail out Linens and Things. The Federal Reserve is there specifically to meet the needs of the banking community, and that was why it was created. Income tax was created at the same time. Obviously, the tax goes to the government, so it's bound up with the Federal Reserve, because the Federal Reserve, however much they might like to claim their independence from the government, needs to know what the government is doing and needs to know where the money is coming from. So there is a linkage there, which is more than just happenstance. Income tax, you know Ron Paul's feeling about income tax. He believes that it is, it actually is unconstitutional, as you all should know, that there is no provision in the Constitution for the government to tax your existence, which is what income tax is all about. The very fact that you exist and that you, you know, get into a motorized conveyance every morning to go to work, that you work and you go home, suddenly you turn around and you find the government's taking money from you. Well, what did you do? You didn't buy anything. You simply carried out a function known as work, and the government took money away from you in consequence. Well, that is a concept which has been espoused by, you know, most countries on earth, but it is, in the eyes of the Constitution, it is illegal. And, of course, income tax is here to stay, but it was voted in secret, practically, sort of late at night, Nobody had a chance to discuss it, rather like the Patriot Act of 2002, which is how the government seems to do these things. And I think there will be another Financial Services Act imminently, which is being prepared, as I mentioned a few days ago. And that's really what happens. Of course, the Federal Reserve is overwhelmingly responsible for the financial state in which we find ourselves today. It's not coincidence that the Federal Reserve is the third central bank of this country. The first two were disbanded ignominiously in shame because they didn't do the job they were supposed to do. And from the end of the second central bank of the United States up until the Federal Reserve's creation in 1913, a period of 70 years, there was, it may surprise you to hear, ladies and gentlemen, no inflation in this country. But from the day the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, there was inflation, and the United States dollar started to lose its value and inexorably lost its value, such that it is now worth about 2 cents in terms of buying power as against the dollar in 1913. That's where we are today, Steve. Hope I answered your question. Thank you very much for it. Let me see. We have one final piece of mail today. We have had a lot of mail today. It's been very encouraging. Jim Sullivan writes in and says, "Hi, Richard. I've heard that Dick Cheney's net worth has gone from under $1 million to over $200 million during his most recent public service as vice president. I've also heard that his investment strategy revolves around rising inflation and a plummeting dollar, among other things. If this is true, do you think investing in what Dick invests in would be a good strategy going forward, Jim?" Jim, you've got me there. I actually have no idea what his investment strategy looks like. If I did, I would probably think that he has the advice which is as good as any available. And I think it would be a good idea to follow it. Probably, yes. You can, however, follow the advice of other people who have been very successful, such as Warren Buffett. It's a rather easier because his company is a public company, so he is kind of more or less obliged to comment and observe on what he is doing and what he has done and what he proposes to do in the future. Doesn't always work, but it often does. And there are other people like George Soros who declare fairly openly their investment strategies. Don't forget that once you've taken an investment, it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't make any difference if you then declare what you have done, because it won't matter anymore because you already had the investment, and furthermore, it might even help you because you're, as they say, talking your investment up. So probably Dick Cheney is useful, but then, of course, you know, he's not an investor, so he doesn't have that amount of experience, I guess, investing. So you'd want to be a little cautious, but certainly not a bad idea to find out what he's doing. Okay, I have an email from Dara Holness, but I think that this is just for me. I think it's just an informational email from the New York Post. I don't think there's anything to talk about. Okay, so let's talk about something else. Let's talk about, you know, I was mentioning before how wrong people could be, and I had mentioned David LeRae and how he was wrong at the top, and now he's wrong certainly at the bottom. If this is not already the bottom, which I don't think it is, it's still a long way down before poor Mr. LeRae decided to capitulate and admit that he was wrong and that he didn't understand, and he condescendingly told us that none of us could understand either. Which I guess is not applicable to those of us listening today. Interestingly enough, there was a 500-page article in the January-February 2000 issue of Foreign Affairs about the price of oil. Foreign Affairs is a prestigious journal about what's going on overseas. And let me read you the first part of the first paragraph. It says, and I quote, "But contrary to much received wisdom, the energy problem looming in the early 21st century is neither skyrocketing prices nor shortages that herald the beginning of the end of the oil age. Instead, the danger is precisely the opposite. Long-term trends point to a prolonged oil surplus and low oil prices over the next two decades. Well, the writers predicted that oil would remain in the $12 to $20 range for another 20 years. Instead, of course, of which we got oil, which did indeed stay between about $30 and $20 for about another 3.5 years. And then it took off, and it's never looked back since, and stands today at $126 a barrel, which is a far cry from $12 to $20 a barrel. Well, things have obviously now come full circle. The latest issue of Foreign Affairs carries an article called Blood Barrels that is in the exact opposite direction of the one that appeared 8 years ago and $100 ago. And the summary reads, and I quote, "Oil wealth often wreaks havoc on a country's economy and politics, helps fund insurgents, and aggravates ethnic grievances." End of quote. From cursing very low oil prices in 2000, they have now gone to the so-called oil curse, Dutch disease, and armed conflict by internal insurgencies. In the 3,000-word article, conflict, as a word, appears 17 times. War, as a word, appears 11 times. Insurgent or insurgency, 7 times. And violent or violence, 4 times. Is there a message there? Well, don't think that that is intended as a prediction that oil prices will move lower any more than David LeRae's own words predict that house prices will move higher. What I'm just doing for you, ladies and gentlemen, is offering you words from so-called experts which don't always ring true. Sometimes we're just dealing with the ebb and flow of the establishment's views on a given subject. And, of course, in this case, it probably is fairly likely, I should think, that their views that oil prices are headed much higher, and I think they're looking at around $200 a barrel, could be an inflection point where, in fact, we're looking at very clear to the end of the economic oil cycle and the possibility that oil prices will, turn over and go back down. Haven't seen any signs of it yet, but, there is a possibility that it's out there. Also, on the matter of oil, you'd heard about this oil holiday, which was proposed by Clinton and McCain. Well, the good news is that the public isn't buying into the idea of this holiday at the pump, even though it's paying a record average $3.61 a gallon. A recent New York Times CBS poll found that 49% of those surveyed said that the gas tax holiday was a bad idea, compared with 45% who said it was a good one. 70% said the proposed holiday was intended to improve the lot of politicians, not of ordinary Americans. Well, it does seem that Americans are, learning a few things about their politicians, which is encouraging. Economists are against the tax holiday, arguing that producers can't supply more gasoline in the short run, which means consumers will pay the same price as before, with producers pocketing the tax saving. If that's the case, if oil supply is inelastic, how do they explain the fact that hurricanes Katrina and Rita knocked out about one-third of U.S. refining capacity in 2005, yet produced only scattered shortages in the affected areas? Forget for a moment about the elasticity of oil supply and focus on the precedent such tomfoolery would set. Every time the price of a key commodity goes up, the government gives the consumer a break and slaps a tax on the producer. We don't want a one-way form of capitalism where it's okay to lose money or make average profits, but when you make above-average returns, the hammer of government comes down on you. That kind of system drives investment out of the sector and starves the economy of what you want most. That was a commentator criticizing the perceived wisdom here. What about the argument that oil companies didn't do anything to deserve such huge profits, that they're getting paid a bundle for doing the same old thing? So this same commentator points to the windfall profits, so-called, earned by builders, speculators, and homeowners during the housing boom, which much of the game exempt from taxes. Now that housing is in the soup, the government is here to help. Well, isn't that nice? One more piece of mail, ladies and gentlemen, then I'm afraid our time is up. It is from Chenise, who writes, "Dear Richard, I am being hounded by the government via direct loans to consolidate my loans before I make payments on them. Do you think consolidation is something I should do? I have not heard favorable things about this." I think it depends what loans you have, Chief. I need to have more information about that. I do tend to think that consolidating loans is a good idea. It's clear that you're going to have to pay them off or declare bankruptcy at some point anyway. Of course, more and more people are now, and this is quite alarming, more and more people are now walking away from homes who are not yet in financial difficulty, who are just simply making the assessment that their homes are underwater, that they're paying now on more than their homes are worth. They might just as well walk away. If this is really how loans are being seen and treated, then clearly you may wish to walk away from your own loan. I'm not suggesting that you do this, but the question of making yourself as invulnerable as possible against the loans that you do have seems to me to be a very intelligent way to do things. And so you should look into that for sure, Janice. I think you should seriously consider whether a consolidating of your loans is not a wise thing to do, absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been interesting talking to you today about the new things that are coming up. We will discuss more of the same on Thursday. In the meantime, time has come to an end, and we must part company. So this is Richard Martin at Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, wishing you a very successful and prosperous week. Bye-bye for now. See you Thursday at 2 p.m.